elected president as quickly as possible. He was referring to the fact that when the proceedings were interrupted for more than 10 hours by the breach of the Capitol, the detailed challenges that many expected would be presented of fraud, ballot stuffing, and violations of Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution in Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin were given short shrift in deference to what a number of senior congressional officials termed the assault on American democracy, represented by what was already being called, both in Congress and on television, the insurrection. Donald Trump maintains that rather than allowing the proceedings to descend into an emotional morass which prejudiced the outcome and dismissed the many valid issues raised about the election without a proper hearing, Mike Pence should have provided an atmosphere for those many members of both houses who had announced their intention to bring the challengers to do so in a professional and secure environment with confidence that the proceedings would be conducted in a fair and objective manner. Mike Pence answered Donald Trump's criticism by saying that he had no right to overturn the results of the presidential election. Speaking to the Conservative Federalist Society in early February, the former vice president said some Republicans believed that as the presiding officer over the joint session of Congress, I possess unilateral authority to reject electoral college votes. And I heard recently President Trump said I had the right to overturn the election. President Trump is wrong. I had no right to overturn the election. Although Trump had used the words overturn the election in a public statement, he was referring to the challenges to the vote counts that many expected would be presented in the half dozen or so swing states referenced earlier. These included a constitutional challenge arising as a consequence of various procedural changes which had been made in the months leading up to the election, and which allowed several million voters to use mail-in ballots for the first time. The joint session, that is, the convening of both houses of Congress in one session, is held on 6th of January following the presidential elections. The House and the Senate jointly convene, and the Electoral College results of each state are presented in the alphabetical order of the names of the individual states for certification by the Vice President, who presides over the proceedings. As the vote counts are presented, the Vice President asks the assembled Congress if there are any objections to the certification of that state's vote. If there are no objections, the certification is presumptively granted. However, if an objection is raised by a member of the House, and if it is joined by a member of the Senate, then the two houses retire to their respective chambers, where the challenge is presented in the form of a trial. If each house sustains the objection, the vote is denied certification and is not counted in the totals. There had been allegations raised in a number of the swing states, including Pennsylvania, Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona, and Nevada, of various types of outright fraud. There was also a claim, a strong one, that for some reason no court had touched the merits of, alleging that recent changes in election practice were done without enabling legislation by the state legislatures, and that therefore the votes that followed from these changes, including a huge and decisive number of newly authorized mail-in ballots, were void, as being in violation of Article 2, Section 1 of the U.S. Constitution. That section says, each state shall appoint, in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct, a number of electors. If those challenges prevailed, there were enough votes in enough swing states which fell into the latter category to hand the election to Donald Trump. The first challenge was raised prior to the Capitol breach in the third state to be offered for certification, that is Arizona. This prompted the two houses to retire to their individual chambers to examine the evidence supporting the claims of irregularity that were to be raised. It was when these sessions were convened that the Capitol security was breached and portions of the building were temporarily occupied. Each of the Senate and the House sessions bore the heavy imprint of the protesters' intrusion, and much of the debate was focused not on the facts and law relevant to the claim, but instead on what was already being termed the insurgency. Upon the return of the joint session, most of the remaining challenges were deferred in favor of a showing of unity against the Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, a day of infamy newly added to a shortlist that included Pearl Harbor and 9/11, where the temple to democracy was desecrated. Had the challenges in two or three of the six swing states been sustained, the outcome of the election would have been changed in favor of Donald Trump.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we went beneath the world's oceans to discover what has happened to the millions of tons of chemical weapons that have been dumped in the sea since the early 20th century. Now, as we have entered the 21st century and forgotten the days of the war, real time bombs are ticking under the seas of the planet. The Baltic Sea, the most polluted sea in the world, is rife with tons of highly toxic and explosive cocktails of chemical weapons inherited from two world wars, which threaten us today. Stay with us for the second part of the documentary as we go across the Atlantic to see the legacy of two world wars all around the United States coast.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive. We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist the fishing vessels that have caught chemical combinations. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
We're in Lahnfurt, Germany. This is where the pipeline comes out of the Baltic Sea, and this is where the gas enters the European gas grid. The munitions issue meant that we had to do extensive detailed surveys. Once the alignments of the pipelines were defined, we then did the detailed munitions surveys. We did very high-resolution side-scan sonar surveys, magnetometer surveys, and bathymetric surveys. And then within the installation corridor, so that's where the pipeline could touch the seabed, we did gradiometer survey works and visual inspections. And out of those, we identified over 400 munitions along the pipeline route. To allow us to have a safe corridor, we had to clear munitions within plus or minus 25 metres of the Nord Stream pipelines. So prior to the installation, we cleared munitions through using detonation techniques in the Gulf of Finland and in Russia. And in Germany, we lifted the munitions that we found close to the route. We had located a number of chemical munitions, and these were avoided.
The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on an investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s of barrels and barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't have any idea where they would be.
In the wake of Bull's investigations, the U.S. Congress called upon the Army to increase its efforts to locate dump sites. That work goes on today at the very facility where the U.S. produced its massive chemical weapons arsenal.
My work here has been mostly archival research on when we started, why we started, where we started dumping chemical munitions. White binders are pretty much all of the information that in the last 5 years we've been able to find on the chemical weapons disposals and some conventional in U.S. waters. It is putting a puzzle together in many, many instances because you find a piece of correspondence, say, that Edgewood's got some 4.2 white phosphorus rounds and some 4.2-inch mustard-filled rounds. We need to dispose of them. They are unsafe, unserviceable. They cannot be reconditioned. So you've got that piece of paper, okay, but all of a sudden you'll get a piece of paper out of Norfolk Navy. I go, wait a minute, now I know what they did with them. And, whoa, we've got the boat. So we go and we find the logbook. And hopefully the captain put in the latlongs. You know, how long did it take him and when he went back to shore? Anytime that you find something that matches up, it's like I can only equate it maybe to a jigsaw puzzle with 10,000 pieces. How long would that take you to put together? I don't know. Don't want to find out.
William Brankovitz was the first to chart U.S. chemical weapons dumping at foreign and domestic sites for the U.S. Defense Department in the 1980s.
Part of the problem at the end of the war was we captured a great number of those chemical weapons, as did the Russians. And we all share some of that legacy today. Some of those chemical weapons were returned to the United States for exploitation, to be looked at and to be evaluated and tested. But the rest of it was, again, thought to be excess to anyone's needs. So a great many of those chemical weapons were taken out to sea and were sea disposed at the time. That pretty much continued right into the 1960s. And in the 1960s, people became concerned about, is this really the way to get rid of chemical weapons? There were a series of chemical weapons disposals that were planned at the end of the 1960s in an operation called Operation Chase. The last one was under a great deal of controversy. By that time, everyone had started to realize that there were potential problems. And so the Army asked the National Academy of Sciences in 1969 to take a look at this problem and do a study and see what the best way was of doing this disposal action. They issued it, and it basically said, due to the fact that we don't know completely how the fate of this material is resolved on the ocean floor, we recommend that you stop sea disposing of chemical weapons. And we moved away at that point in time completely from ocean disposal of chemical weapons. I think about 2 years later, in 1972, there was a congressional act that made it illegal.
The Pentagon began a pilot program to study environmental effects off the coast of Hawaii, where it dumped tons of conventional and chemical munitions over the decades.
I think we've all learned things, that the ocean is not a garbage dump. And if you dump something into the ocean, it does have environmental effects. When you understand that today we're taking a look to see what those effects are, we're looking at the fish, we're looking at the other biota in the sea to see what effect it has had to determine whether removal is an appropriate course of action. What is down there has been down there 30, 40, 50 or more years, in some cases 80 years. There's a lot of work the environment has done on these munitions, and that work has been to slowly dissolve them and absorb them. And when we're not finding a adverse impact to health, life, safety, leave in place is continuing to be the right solution. I'm not saying that we won't find a location where we make a different decision. But when we're using a science-based approach, we really want there to be an understanding of the effect on the environment, an understanding on the effect on people, an understanding of what happens when we bring it up out of the water. Is that really the safest, most risk-averse manner of handling this?
The United States and Great Britain have extended official secrecy until 2017. And for the last 60 years, scientific research on chemical weapons in the sea and the dangers they pose has been limited because of this military control. Canada launched a big effort to dispose of chemical weapons during World War II. One retired Army mine clearing expert has combined environmental concern with an entrepreneurial approach and become a crusader for cleanup.
Good afternoon, I'm Wendy Bergfeld, and this is Bain Street. And on today's program, a conversation with Terry Long, a former military engineer and explosive ordnance disposal expert, more than 30 years experience, and he is sounding the alarm. Our conversation on today's edition of Main Street.
I was born in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and I grew up here. Cape Breton Island is an island. We have a big lake in the middle of it called the Bedore Lakes. It's a very beautiful island, pristine in some areas. When you start looking at in the Bedore Lakes, there's actually five munition sites, and one is a chemical weapons disposal site from after the Second World War. Johnstown was used for a chemical weapons facility.
everything was secret. They didn't want people to know that this was actually being manufactured here. It was the same thing after the war when they started to look at decommissioning. It was basically just tear down the structures and leave it. And there was, again, no knowledge that it was a chemical weapons site, so nobody would suspect anything there at all. So when I started looking at that, I started feeling compelled that I had to do something to protect our lake. And then when I started looking outside of Nova Scotia, again, I was getting shocked. All these different munition sites all along the eastern seaboard, all along the west coast of Canada, and all around the world, from the Baltic Sea to the Sea of Japan. The first thing I did is I did a Canadian Senate hearing, and I took the First Nations of Wagobok with me so we could actually talk about it from the perspective of First Nations, as them being the keeper of Mother Earth. So at the Senate hearing, we discussed the different sites, what some of the contaminants are. Two recommendations came out. The first was the United Nations should have an international conference to address sea dump munitions. The second was is we needed to develop a stakeholders group that encompassed everybody to actually look at the effects from the munitions. So what happened is because there was no international conference, I developed the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions, and that became the international platform for munitions.
My name is Albert Marshall, and I am from the Moose Clan. I am from Mi'kma'ki, the Mi'kmaq territory, back during the war. We used to see these planes going back and forth. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of bombs dumped into the Bordeaux Lakes. Harry Long informed me of what compounds that these bombs had, because in a lot of our observations, we used to see a lot of unusual lesions in some of these aquatic life. Personally, I've had 6-7 members of my immediate family that have died from various strains of cancer. And even as we speak, I have a granddaughter at the Children's Hospital in Halifax with cancer. Bordeaux Lakes has been a lifeline for our people for so long. Factoring our 7 generations, we have to also ensure that our future generations will also have the same privileges as we have today.
Canadian authorities had never admitted that chemical weapons were dumped in the Bordeaux Lakes, but they haven't denied it either. And for Terry Long, that silence speaks volumes. Concerns that dump sites cannot be cleaned up without injury to humans and damage to the environment has hindered such efforts. But Japanese officials, pushed by economic interests, decided to move ahead. They founded the first industrial program to clean up chemical weapons in the seas. But Imperial Japan produced large quantities of weapons containing mustard gas and lewisite in the 1930s. They used them against civilians during the invasion of Manchuria in 1937, killing thousands. Poison gases were produced here at Okunoshima Island. The work was so secret the island was removed from Japanese maps during World War II. Today the island is called Bunny Island. The bombs in the Kanda port lie just 10 meters deep, and the Japanese government negotiated a contract with Kobelco, a giant steel corporation, to clear the weapons and destroy them. Kobelco technology is beginning to interest other countries like the United States, Belgium, and France. The Kanda experience and Kobelco's cutting-edge research with underwater robotics demonstrates safe cleanups can be conducted in depths of up to 150 meters safely for humans and the environment. One million tons of chemical weapons lie in the depths of the seas. Some have been there for more than 70 years now. Most countries clearly don't want to take responsibility for cleaning up their own weapons. And many other munitions belong to no country. For example, who will pay for the weapons made by Germany during World War II and dumped by the Allies? The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which won the 2013 Nobel Peace Prize, has a mandate to end the spread of chemical weapons around the globe. Since 1992, 190 countries have signed the convention prohibiting chemical weapons. However, the OPCW has never taken a stance on the issue of munitions dumped in the sea.
Ensure that the convention's objects and purposes to exclude completely the possibility of the use of chemical weapons is fulfilled.
Terry Long, with the support of Baltic state officials, brought his group and the problem to The Hague last spring to urge the organization to support clean-up efforts.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody here today to this side event at the LIPA room. My name is Terence Patrick Long. I'm the chairman of the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions. What is desperately needed is ownership and leadership and the coordination of international efforts to adequately address sea dump chemical munitions.
We think that time is really ripe to act because weapons are surfacing and calling for action. We are truly convinced that the member state of the OPCW will finally listen to us.
Every now and then people are asking us, is the leakage increasing or not, or is the environmental damage ongoing? We cannot answer them with the degree of certainty we would like to have.
The worldwide dumping of sea dump chemical munitions by the international community was a mistake. We all seriously need to accept the obvious, that substances that are too toxic to touch with the ungloved hand has no place in our marine environment.
It's urgent that scientists be free to continue their research. The military secrecy imposed by the Allies since the Potsdam Conference in 1945 must be lifted. This is essential to effectively evaluate the risks these weapons pose to man, the environment, and the food chain.
That the states involved in creating this disaster will finally clean up and take responsibility for their previous actions before it is too late and the legacy of the world wars takes its toll on the world's next generation. Let's wait and see. And that's it for this week. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, almost two-thirds of tenants over the age of 65 have cut back on their general spending as a result of the cost of living crisis, and campaigners are warning that older people who do not own their homes are particularly vulnerable to rising fuel bills. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Hilary Osborne. The piece is titled, Older UK Renters Forced to Cut Back on Spending as Living Costs Soar. In Britain, almost two-thirds of tenants over the age of 65 have cut back on their general spending as a result of the cost of living crisis. And campaigners are warning that older people who do not own their homes are particularly vulnerable to rising electricity and fuel bills. Research shared with Guardian Money by the charity Independent Age puts the spotlight on the struggles of older tenants who are battling to keep up with rising household costs. Its survey found that 62% of renters over the age of 65 were having to cut back on their general spending, and that they were more likely to be doing so than their contemporaries who were homeowners. A quarter said they would not be able to afford a £10 a month increase in their living costs, while 71% said they would not be able to cover a £50 rise. More than half said they felt anxious about their finances. The state's pension increased by 3.1% last month, well below the 7% inflation rate recorded in March. Energy bills went up at the same time, and with a further increase likely this October, economists have predicted inflation could go above 10% before the end of the year. Older private renters are particularly vulnerable to soaring inflation, particularly where rents have been rising too, says Dan Wilson-Craw, the deputy director of the campaign group Generation Rent. Unlike homeowners who are likely to have paid off their mortgage, they still have housing costs. If landlords want to raise the rent to reflect the wider market, there is little current tenants can do. For retirees on fixed incomes, this cuts their disposable income or forces them to move. Independent Age's survey of 2,000 adults in England over the age of 65, of whom 391 were renting, found that 57% of tenants were cutting back on heating. 42% said they had reduced how much food and drink they were buying. And 29% were buying less vehicle fuel. Aside from those most essential purchases, 46% said that they had cut back on clothing and on footwear purchase, and 39% had reduced their social activities. Separate figures from Shelter show that between the financial years of 2020-2021 and 2021-2022, there was a 20% increase in the number of over-65s contacting its helpline who were at risk of homelessness. Francisca, a 64-year-old, and her husband Colin, a 70-year-old, say their rent has risen by more than 7% this year. They are struggling to cover it and the other bills they face, despite making cutbacks. When we go to the supermarket, we are buying the cheapest of the cheap, she says. We're taking fewer baths, fewer showers. We turn the lights off. Even on cold days, we turn the heating off. Although the couple chose to rent because, says Francisca, we're not sure what the future holds, she says it has left them vulnerable. They have lived in poor housing in the past while paying a high rent. Were evicted through a Section 21 no-fault eviction by one previous landlord and have also had problems with letting agencies. This has made them very nervous about what happens when their contract ends next March. Their age has financial implications. At our stage of life, we have a pot of money, and if we live a long life, we have to stretch it over that time, she says. We can't go to work 9 to 5 or get new careers, so we rely on freelancing. Morgan Vine, the Independent Age head of policy, says older renters are left in increasingly precarious financial situations and need help and protection from the government. Our research found that older renters are one of the most at-risk groups of dropping into poverty past state pension age and are more likely to experience long-term poverty, she says. Day-to-day, we also know older renters are at an increased risk of living in poor quality homes and face higher costs and greater financial insecurity than other groups as a result. Morgan Vine says older renters have shared concerns with the charity about high rents and that their landlords could sell up at any time. With a cost of living crisis squeezing people's budgets from every angle, these worries are only going to get worse, she says. Renters make up the minority of households in England, with a head aged 65 or over, according to the latest official figures. The latest data shows there are 5.5 million owner-occupiers in this age range and 5.1 million own their home outright, which means no monthly mortgage costs. There are only 382,000 households in the private sector headed by an older person and 1 million in the social rented sector. Housing associations are allowed to put up rents by 4.1% in April, and many tenants who rent from them have seen increases. In the private rented sector, it is not easy to see what is happening to existing tenancies, but newly advertised contracts are typically costing more than a year ago. Polly Neat, the chief executive of Shelter, says older tenants are likely to be on low incomes, which would mean pressure from rising costs. With bills skyrocketing and private rents the highest on record, it's no wonder our emergency helpline is picking up the phone to older renters who, instead of preparing for retirement, are facing homelessness. No one should be forced to choose between eating or paying their rent, she says. Wilson Crawl says the state pension has risen by less than inflation, but it's worse for private renters relying on housing benefit, which has been frozen since 2020. If these people are paying higher rents, that money could be coming out of the rest of their income, and that's before we even think about rising energy prices. Wilson Crow adds, we need a freeze on rents and another suspension of evictions to protect tenants during this crisis.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 4, 2018. Just take a look at the behavior of the American statesman. Their style of speech is similar to that of psychopathic personalities. They make threats. They order assassinations. They slander. They helplessly beg for assistance. They attack the stability and security of other nations. One of the most prominent points of the Imam's path, which is reflected in his testament and all his remarks, is the need for determined resistance against covetous, arrogant powers. The Iranian nation and all the different political groups, as well as the elites inside the country who are loyal to the Imam and his thoughts, and decisions must safeguard this stance with full strength. The Imam himself had a similar attitude. He never stopped supporting the oppressed throughout the world out of his disdain towards the global tormentors. He used to refer to the Palestinian cause as a central issue at all times. In his testament and his remarks, he made explicit the point that he considered the oppressed nations urge for support as important. He openly announced his support for the rights of the oppressed Palestinian nation, as well as all other oppressed nations. That is the path of the Imam. That is the Imam's way and advice. Fortunately, the Iranian nation and the government officials have pursued this path. And it is 30 years now that you, the Iranian nation, has been successful and has defeated the enemies whenever it faced American arrogance.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
March 1, 2022. The Americans even felt the need to give birth to a creature called Daesh, or ISIS, which was their trained dog. This creature was trained to publicly film the beheading, burning, and drowning of individuals. It was the U.S. that created this creature. They themselves acknowledged that they created that creature. They are the generators of crisis. If they fail to generate crisis, then their weapons manufacturing factories will not be able to reap maximum benefits. Therefore, they have to create crisis in the world in order to maximize the profit of these mafias.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The Pentagon's ever-growing budget is quite simply a theft from American people, enriching some of the wealthiest corporations in this country, said one critic, adding, it's disgraceful. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kenny Stencil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Revolting. Senate panel adds another $45 billion to Biden's military budget. Here's more. Progressives responded with disgust after the Senate Armed Services Committee voted to tack an additional $45 billion on top of President Joe Biden's already massive military spending request, bringing the total proposed budget for the coming fiscal year to a staggering $857.6 billion. The Biden administration's March request for $813 billion in military spending for fiscal year 2023 represented a $31 billion increase over the current level of $782 billion, which is already unprecedented. During its closed-door markup of the National Defense Authorization Act, the Senate Armed Services Committee approved a bill with a top-line budget of $847 billion, $817 billion of which is earmarked for the Pentagon. Roughly $10 billion of national military spending falls outside the Senate panel's jurisdiction. The House is expected to make its own push to further boost military spending for the next fiscal year. William Harting, a senior research fellow at the Queen's Institute for Responsible Statecraft, called the Senate panel's decision misguided. The administration's proposal is already higher than spending at the peaks of the Korean and Vietnam Wars and over $100 billion more than at the height of the Cold War, Harting said in a statement, adding, "Throwing more money at the Pentagon will not make us safer. It will just divert funds from addressing other urgent challenges like pandemics and climate change that put millions of Americans at risk." Monica Montgomery, a research analyst at the Council for a Livable World, pointed out that the Senate committee's proposed $45 billion increase in military spending is equivalent to Biden's entire budget request for climate programs, demonstrating how Congress will value militarism and defense contractors over a livable future. If Congress truly wants to keep people safe, they must start by rejecting this increase and investing taxpayer dollars in human well-being instead, Tory Bateman, policy advocacy coordinator at the American Friends Services Committee, said in a statement. Earlier this week, Representatives Barbara Lee and Mark Pocan, co-chairs of the Defense Spending Reduction Caucus, introduced the People Over Pentagon Act of 2022, which proposes cutting Pentagon spending for the next fiscal year by $100 billion and reallocating those funds toward threats facing the U.S. that are not military in nature, such as the COVID-19 pandemic, the climate emergency, and worsening inequality. Although a majority of U.S. voters are opposed to military spending in excess of $800 billion, earlier efforts to slash the Pentagon's budget have failed to gain enough support to pass the House or Senate, thanks in part to lawmakers who receive significant amounts of campaign cash from the weapons industry, which benefits from constantly ballooning expenditures. Roughly 55% of all Pentagon spending went to private sector military contractors from fiscal year 2002 to fiscal year 2021, according to Stephen Semler of the Security Policy Reform Institute. If this privatization of funds rate over the last 20 years holds, Selmer wrote in December, arms dealers will gobble up an estimated $407 billion in public money in fiscal year 2022. In the words of Win Without War President Stephen Miles, the Pentagon's ever-growing budget is quite simply a theft from American people, enriching some of the wealthiest corporations in this country. Julia Gale-Hill, an analyst at the Project on Government Oversight Center for Defense Information, concurred. Increasing the Pentagon budget beyond President Biden's request isn't just irresponsible. It's a slap in the face to American taxpayers, said Gale-Hill. adding, year after year, the Department of Defense demonstrates its lack of fiscal discipline, failing financial audits, and sinking money into weapon programs that do little more than enrich defense contractors. This $45 billion increase isn't about national security or the American people, she added. It's about funneling money into the military-industrial complex. Senator Jack Ree, chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, told reporters recently that inflation was the first consideration in increasing the top line. He also cited the need to support some countries, replenish weapons sent to aid the countries, and fund military priorities not included in Biden's Pentagon request, Politico reported. The committee's ranking Republican, Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, hailed the proposed spending like as everything he hoped for. Experts, meanwhile, have documented how military spending has never moved in tandem with inflation. They have also warned that the nearly $60 billion worth of weaponry that Ukraine has already received from the U.S. is more likely to intensify the war than to advance peace, with arms manufacturers among the only beneficiaries of such prolonged suffering. The Senate Armed Services Committee's move to increase U.S. military spending comes despite the Biden administration's withdrawal from Afghanistan following 20 years of failed war. Robert Weisman, president of Public Citizen, a progressive advocacy group that is pushing the U.S. to ramp up vaccine manufacturing and inoculate the world against COVID-19 with an investment of just $25 billion, or roughly 3% of the nation's annual military budget, said that the Senate Armed Services Committee's choice to defy both the president and public opinion and flood the Pentagon with more money is outrageous. Weisman said, time and again, Congress funnels billions in additional funds to costly weapons programs, war, and defense contractors, while claiming that human needs would cost too much. Most Americans oppose efforts to rocket launch military spending towards $1 trillion per year. Lawmakers should reject this and champion human-centered spending instead.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Cheongwa-dae, South Korea's Blue House, is now open to the public. The presidential office has moved, with the former grounds becoming a park and popular attraction. The move was finalized just weeks before incoming President Yoon Suk-yeol's inauguration. The new office is in South Korea's Ministry of National Defense, adjacent to a U.S. military base, with the government this week opening a park there on a 10-day trial. President Yoon moved the presidential office to leave behind what he called the era or symbol of imperial power and get closer to the people. It's been suggested that visitors to this park will be able to see the president working in his fifth-floor office. Just one problem. The park is polluted with toxins in the soil and groundwater many times the levels otherwise considered safe. An environmental catastrophe a long time in the making, say activists.
These facilities have never been restored from their use by the Japanese Army and then the U.S. Army. You can find the boiler tubes and pipelines, which have decayed underground, leaking oil, resulting in the gradual accumulated contamination of the soil, not just from 1 or 2 years, but over decades.
The U.S. base is in the process of returning to South Korean control. According to government surveys, benzene, xylene, and other hydrocarbons, as well as arsenic and cancer-causing dioxins, have been detected at harmful levels in more than 60% of the area.
After the entire U.S. base is returned, they should execute a detailed investigation into how contaminated it is and establish a plan to clean up the pollution. And after the cleanup is carried out and verified, then the park can finally be built. According to the original government plan, it'll take about 7 years.
The Yoon administration plans to open the park fully in September and feature an American-themed culture zone, or Little L.A. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Scads of emails to FIFA and no answers yet. Following the Canadian national soccer team's pullout from a planned match with Iran, pressures have been heaping on Canada's footballing body, Canada Soccer, for what Iranian sports authorities regard as unsportsmanlike and illegal. They have been trying different ways to reach FIFA for answers, but to no avail.
In several attempts, I tried to contact FIFA to ask for an interview with its chief executive officer, but there was no response. I also emailed their media department, but so far we have received no answer.
The Iran match was due to take place on June 5th in Vancouver as a preparatory friendly in the lead-up to the 2022 FIFA World Cup in Qatar. But 9 days ahead of the game, Canada Soccer canceled the fixture, citing untenable geopolitical situation of hosting Iran. The exhibition match was called off days after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau criticized Canada Soccer for its decision to host Iran.
It's a pity that a country like Canada, which claims to be committed to the separation of politics from sports, so openly disregards this principle and mixes up political hostilities against Iran with the sport. It's definitely a violation of the FIFA regulations.
Days later, Team Canada set another match with Panama to replace the Iran contest. But to everyone's surprise, that game too was called off at the 11th hour. This time, Canada Soccer cited payment disputes raised by the Canadian players as the reason why the Panama match was cancelled. To Iran's sports ministry, Canada's flip-flopping is against the FIFA regulations and deserves punishment.
Our colleagues at the Iranian Football Federation are following up on the legal pursuit of the case. We are currently writing to the Canadian Soccer Association to seek a convincing answer regarding why they committed such a move. We will then take the case to FIFA to seek psychological and financial compensation for Canada's illegal action.
The Iran match was a golden chance for the 38th-ranked Canadian men to test their performance against a team that ranks 21st in the world. Now with the World Cup looming, and just 4 years prior to serving as co-host of the 2026 Men's World Cup, Canada Soccer has embroiled itself in a crisis that has the potential of leaving indelible scars on Canada's sport and its image in the world. 3 weeks after Canada Soccer's controversial move, the backlash is yet to subside. Iran says it's seriously following up on its legal pursuit to seek damages, and that has raised speculations about the possibility of the case being taken to the Court of Arbitration for Sports, known as CAS. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Humanitarian aid being loaded into a lorry. I'm heading with pro-Russian volunteers to a village near the front line, which is constantly under shelling in order to deliver much-needed supplies. Despite the destruction all around, incredibly, people still live here. We stop off next to the final checkpoint. Beyond is no man's land, the grey zone between the opposing armies. Artillery can be heard. It's unclear whether it's Russian or Ukrainian.
Now it is from both sides. Artillery duels. And we're in the middle. The shells are flying over our heads. And they might fall here. So let's just gradually move away.
Pieces of shrapnel like this are supposed to hit us. This one is small. They're bigger ones. Look how sharp it is. They cut through flesh like a sieve. These are Ukrainian gifts to our children. They're different shapes and sizes. You could keep it as a souvenir from Donbass.
Unexpectedly, in this wasteland, a bus pulls up. The man tells me his house was destroyed yesterday. He shows me his wounds. I asked him why he's come back. To get some documents and feed his cat, he says. A crowd is gathered at the drop-off point,